right, let's try this again. For anyone who was there, I just started this a minute ago and there was no sound, so I think I got it working now. A day full of technical challenges. So I'm here today again. I am Dan Taxationist Theft Berman, your presidential choice for 2020. Welcome back, Isaac. Can you hear me now? So I'm doing another town hall sort of event tonight. Basically, there are a couple issues that I've seen people talking about, and I thought they'd be great conversations. If you have any comments, go ahead and stick them in the comments where they belong. If you have any questions, stick those also in the comments. And if you have any response to anything that I'm saying, put it in the comments. And, I am reading these things and I will try to respond to any of them. And so, one interesting thing you're going to find about me is I really do like to have my ideas challenged. I know a lot of people, they don't really like that, right? They like to say, here's my idea, here's my plan, it's so great. And if you don't think it's great, well, there's something wrong with you. I'm not like that at all. In fact, a lot of the positions that I have now are positions that I have because people challenged my original positions. So I learn, I grow, and I do that from getting feedback from people. And this is very important. And I think this is something that's missing with a lot of our politicians. They come in, they have these plans, and they will do whatever it takes to get these plans, passed or however they manifest, without any regard for the fact that this is actually going to hurt people, and they're not listening to the people that it's going to hurt. So this is a very important part of the process that I find, and it's really important to have these conversations and see, okay, where can we take this? My entire platform has been designed around the idea that, all these politicians come with plans saying, hey, we're going to take from this person, but we're going to make things so much better for this person over here. And what I see is we don't need to do that. If we stop taking things to the extremes, we can actually come up with programs that benefit everybody, right? There's no taking from one person to give to somebody else. It's everybody benefits from it. Nobody's harmed by it. And that's a really important quality for all of these solutions to have. Because if we're hurting people, well, who's to say that these people are more deserving of what they're getting than the other people who are, less deserving to not be harmed by these policies being implemented? So today I wanted to talk about capitalism versus socialism. There are a lot of discussions going on right now about, people saying capitalism is bad. And it's really an interesting subject, right? Because usually we hear capitalism versus socialism, and it's one or the other. It's some sort of extreme. And people who have objections to capitalism, I hear these objections, and this is one thing that we all do, right? That we kind of need to stop. When somebody says your idea is called X and I don't like X, they're not attacking you or your ideas. They're just attacking the name that's attached to it. And so what's really important is that, one person's concept of what capitalism is not the same as what another person's version of capitalism is. We see the same thing with socialism, right? We see all these countries who have tried socialism and completely failed, and everybody else comes along and says, well, it hasn't, real socialism hasn't been tried. Democratic socialism hasn't been tried. Small variations to the same plan. And there are certainly flaws with capitalism if you look at, all of the flaws that people point out, where you've got big corporations taking advantage of people and paying them very low wages, these sorts of things. The important thing to realize about this, though, and this is the biggest distinction between the two. Under capitalism, and I'll get into like some of the more specific arguments on this. Under capitalism, you are free to do whatever you want. Now, I'll say the same thing the socialists say under real capitalism, because what we have in the United States today is not real capitalism. It's government control, right? Government controls everything. I'll get into more details on that. Socialism is kind of based on the foundation that everybody has to participate in the same system. And if you don't want to be a part of that, too bad, you have to. If you want to go, if you want to go work your own fields and grow your own food, too bad. that's food that everyone else could be sharing. So that now belongs to the government. This is the whole concept, right? You can't disassociate from this type of society. So you're basically forced to be a part of this system that you don't believe in. With capitalism, idealistically, that would not be the case. If you said, hey, I don't want anything to do with this system, you could go off and do your own thing. This is a very important part of this, the distinction between the two, because under capitalism, you know, if you say I want nothing to do with capitalism, you're free to not participate in capitalism. Now, the flaw where that comes down is, you know, because a lot of people say, well, I have to wake up every day, I have to go to work, I have to get a job, I have to earn money, I have to pay my bills, I have to pay for food, I have to pay for all this stuff that should be given to me for free because it's a human right. Well, you have to work for that. And people say that that's not, these are basic human rights, right? Food and water and air, you've got to pay for all this, right? A roof over your head, you've got to pay for it. And this is where we see the sort of the flaw in capitalism. Why are we being forced to work a job? Jobs are, it's a relatively new invention. If you go back 1,000 years, people weren't concerned with having a 40-hour job. This is a relatively new thing, right? So why is this so important now? And they blame this on capitalism, but the reality is that's not capitalism. That's statism. That's the government that is kind of forcing you into this, right? So let's say most of the country is capitalist and you say, I want nothing to do with that. You could say, well, I don't want to work for money so that I can buy food. I just want to grow my own food. You could find a little piece of land that's completely unoccupied and you could say, I'm going to plant food here. I'm going to build a house here. And that's that. And if you wanted to do that, that would be fine. Unfortunately, you can't do that in the United States because whatever land isn't already owned by somebody is owned by the government. And even the land that is owned by people, if you own a house, you know, if there's a piece of property that's been passed down from generation to generation in your family, you have to pay the government property tax. That is not capitalism, that is government. So this is a very important distinction because capitalism is usually taking the blame for this. And we can't, you know, we have to understand, we see this all the time. When one thing is blamed for a problem and it's not responsible for that problem, what happens? The wrong thing gets the blame. The wrong person gets the blame. The wrong program gets shut down. The wrong person goes to jail. We need to make sure that when we see a problem, we're diagnosing it correctly. We understand the problem. We understand the root of the problem. And if we want it to change, how and where to change it. So when we talk about having to work, having to, you know, some people compare this to slavery. You have to work just to stay alive. Well, to some degree, that's just a fact of nature, right? If you were put here on Earth just by yourself and nobody else, you're going to have to work to pick food or to hunt. You know, it's a small amount of work, and it's work that only benefits yourself, but it's work, right? In capitalism, what you say is, okay, I am going to learn how to specialize and do one thing, and I'll get money and I'll trade the money instead because I don't want to hunt. It's easier for me to do something else, make shoes, write computer software. That's what I do. You know, whatever it may be, assemble cars, paint, perform art, music. All these things that you can do in exchange for money, and then you can take that money and you can go buy food because you're not a hunter. That's not something that you're really good at. Meanwhile, other people are really good at hunting. So it's just a system that makes things really easier for everybody. So, hey Jennifer from Illinois and Isaac, what's going on? If you guys have any questions or comments, or if you think I'm wrong, go ahead and stick them in the comments. So another issue about capitalism that I've heard recently is this idea that the CEO, let's just say there's usually different levels of management, but let's just look at a small company with a CEO and different employees. And there was an example someone was discussing today about the employees making shoes. And the theory against capitalism, the argument against capitalism here is that without the employees, the CEO wouldn't be able to make his shoes and he wouldn't be able to make millions of dollars. This is a true statement. The theory is that if it takes one person 1 hour to make a shoe, and that person is being paid $5 an hour, and then the shoe is taken and sold for $100, that the CEO is abusing that employee by taking 95% of the value of what he just produced. Now, there are many different ways to look at this. So we'll start with one, and that's the employee. What does the employee add of value to this business, right? Now, they did create the shoe from scratch, right? But where did they get the materials? The materials have a cost too, right? So the employee usually doesn't create the materials. The materials are purchased from another company. That other company has employees. Those employees are paid. It also has a CEO who makes a profit. The employee at the shoe factory is now making this shoe, and he puts it in a box and gives it to somebody else, and it's shipped somewhere. Every single step of this process costs more money. So first, let's look at the employee who costs $5 to make the shoe and the final sale price of $100. That $95 does not all go to the CEO. There's the transportation companies, the trucking companies, the gas companies that sell gas to the trucks. There's the entire retail chain who actually stocks and sells the shoes. There's the fact that they're producing hundreds of extra shoes that are just going to sit in a stock room, right? Because when you have a shoe store, you don't know exactly which customers are going to come in and which styles they're going to like or what sizes they're going to wear. So what do? You stock lots of them, extra ones, right? And those are going to be sitting there. You're never going to be able to sell them. And this is, you know, okay, when it goes out of style, you'll sell them for less at a discounted price, the clearance sales and all this. Yeah, all that stuff happens, but there's no guarantee that for every single box that this one employee sends out of this company that it's going to ever be sold for $100. So there is a lot of risk along the way. Now, the employee doesn't take any of that risk on, right? He makes a shoe, he takes an hour, he gets $5. That's a guarantee, right? But the company who's responsible for that shoe, they take that shoe and they're responsible to the stockholders and everybody else. They're responsible to take that shoe and sell it for as much as they possibly can. They might sell it for $20, right? It's only $15 profit before a bunch of other expenses, taxes and all that. They make $15. They're responsible for making sure, okay, we have all these shoes that we produced. We've got to sell them. We have to make sure they're sold. How do they do that? They hire a sales team. They hire an advertising and marketing team, right? This is another expense. Now, what does the CEO do? Let's get back to the CEO for a minute. Could, you know, the theory, going back to the anti-capitalist theory, is that all of these people would somehow, if the CEO weren't there, would somehow be able to arrange themselves and say, we're going to produce shoes and we're going to sell them and we're going to keep all the profits for ourselves. Now, this doesn't happen. I mean, you can say it would be a great idea. It would be a great idea. But the reality is this doesn't happen. Usually, sometimes you have a startup where you have five or six friends who get together and they say, okay, look, here's the idea. I know how to design shoes. I know how to make shoes. I know how to do advertising and marketing. They'll all get together and they'll all say, okay, let's put this all together. But at the end of the day, there's only six of them. And as the company grows, they need more people. Where do they find more people? They have to hire people, right? A lot of the people that they hire are not interested in owning part of the company, in taking part of that extra interest, right? And so they come along and their only incentive is, no, I just need some money. I don't care about owning the company. I don't want to take on the risk. I don't want to make shoes for free for the next 6 months before we sell the shoes. And, you know, like that's what happens when you have a startup, right? You're paying the employees. The employees are guaranteed to get paid. But if you're just producing and producing and producing product and you're not sure if you're going to sell them yet, usually the people who start the company don't even take a paycheck until that company becomes profitable. They're in there working for free from the very beginning. Meanwhile, the employees are guaranteed a paycheck. So there's, you know, it's there are different payoffs. Now, all that said, of course, it would be very nice, and if more employees demanded it, they would actually get it. The thing is, most employees don't ask for this. If employees actually got stock in the companies they worked for, that would give them a small percentage of the ownership. That would actually give them the profit, the return that they're working so hard to build. But most employees are not interested in this. They're not interested in taking that. You know, socialism is the idea that the workers would own the factory, right? The workers would own the means of production. And that's absolutely possible under capitalism. If people would speak up and say, well, look, we've been working for you. We're not happy with what we're getting paid. Give us stock options. Give us some of this. Now, what's interesting about that is a lot of companies that you work for, their stocks aren't always just going up. They're not always profitable. You know, we look at some of the big companies like Apple and Starbucks, and yeah, they're very profitable. But the number of employees that they have, if they were to take all of their profit and spread it among all of their employees and give them, you know, a few shares of stock, the amount of stock that would be is really not a whole lot, because you take into consideration, okay, this company is making, you know, let's say this company makes $1 billion in profit, and you divide that by what, 1 million employees, that's $1,000. So that's what, $100 a month? It's not a huge amount of money. Sure, $100 a month is nice, but it's not a huge amount of money. Compare that to the amount that the government takes out of that person's check in all these programs that most people are not going to see the benefits from. Your Social Security, your federal income tax, your unemployment insurance, all these other programs. These are all coming out of your check, and most people never get any of that money returned. So, you know, what's interesting about, you know, even the math just doesn't add up on this one. The unemployment tax, right? You're paying this every month. You could have a job for 30 years and you're paying into that every single month. And when you finally lose your job, if they give you benefits from that thing that you've been paying, you would never recover all of the money that you've been putting in for the last 30 years. Because those programs are not indefinite. They tell you, oh, it's only good for 6 months or 12 months, and we're not going to pay you what you were making. We're going to give you a fraction of that. It's capped at a certain level, or, you know, all these rules apply. So you're not going to make all this money back. And so if you look at what, you know, when a socialist or a progressive comes along and says, yeah, these companies shouldn't be making these profits, if you were to distribute all that money, you're not going to be doing that much good for these people as if you would just stop stealing from their paychecks. Now, here's the other thing. We talked about, you know, could these employees somehow coordinate and arrange themselves to start this business? Yeah, it's possible. It's legal. They could. But why don't they? We have seen instances of people starting socialist cafes, coffee shops, you know, little restaurants where all of the employees are owners in the business. They don't work for money. They, you know, I'm not sure exactly how they work, but they always fail. And this is because that entire system is based on the idea that everybody's going to somehow just, you know, everyone's going to do their best, even though they have absolutely no incentive to continue to do better. And so we see that model and it fails all the time. There aren't a lot of employees who want to run a business. There aren't a lot of employees who want to start a business. Given the option, they would rather find a job and just do the work with the minimum responsibility. Because at the end of the day, people don't like manufacturing cars, right? If that's what, if you didn't have to do anything, you might spend some time innovating, figuring out how to make a car better for yourself, maybe for your friends. You might make a hobby out of it, but you're not going to try to figure out how to mass produce hundreds of thousands or millions of cars just because you're bored and you've got nothing better to do. That's not what people do. You know, there's always the thought of, you know, hey, you know, what if we did this? But in that transition to that type of system, if you do a forceful transition to that system and you take a company and you forcefully take it from these CEOs who are maybe making millions and shareholders, and you take everything away from them and you give it to the workers and the management is gone, the company fails because they don't see. Well, and maybe they see, but the people who come up with this idea to give ownership to the employees, 100% to the employees, they don't see the value that the CEO and the management add, right? They do add value to these companies. They do arrange all the pieces, right? You might be really great at building a car, but you don't know how to sell them. And so there's a marketing company, there's a marketing branch of the company that knows all that, that figures all that out. And sometimes these branches of these companies work together and they make it all work. But there's really a lot going on here. So it's really, you know, it's oversimplifying it to say, well, let's just get rid of the CEOs and let's get rid of the shareholders and let's just give everything to the employees. It's just not going to work. It's been tried. It doesn't work. So this is another attack against capitalism that I think is really overblown. And it's not that people are stupid. It's not that people are violent and just want to do something. It's, you know, they see a flaw in the system. They see I'm getting screwed. That guy's making a lot of money. Why aren't I? And how can we fix this? And that's a solution that, you know, most people, they don't even come up with it. They're told about this idea and they're told about how great it is. And of course, that's how socialism always starts, right? Somebody comes along and says, oh, you're not making a whole lot of money, but look at that guy. Look at how rich he is. You should be rich too. Let's take his money. That's fundamentally what it is. And it sounds great in the beginning. You know, you're convinced that, oh, well, that guy has money because he's been doing something evil. He must be a bad person because how could he have so much money? Only thieves have that much money. It's not. It's because they found a smarter way to organize things and to make money for themselves. And in doing so, they figured out how to give value to somebody else, right? Now, let's talk about this for a minute. There are two types of wealthy people. Wealthy people who have legitimately and ethically become wealthy, and other people who have not legitimately and ethically become wealthy. This is a very important distinction, right? When we talk about capitalism and how bad it is, a lot of people will point out everybody who's wealthy must have gotten it through unethical means. The only ethical means to earn a living is to work really hard and get your paycheck. But that's not true at all. There are, you know, a lot of people get wealthy because they solve problems for people, right? If you have a plumbing issue in your house, what do? You call a plumber. Why? Because you have a problem and you might not know how to solve it. Or maybe you do and you don't have the time. So you pay somebody else to do it, right? Now, plumbers make a lot of money. And this is just an ethical exchange of, I have some money, I need a service. If you could please do this for me, I will give you some money. Of course, there's an unethical side to that. And that unethical side is, if your next door neighbor knows how to fix the problem, but he's not licensed by the government, then he's not allowed to do it for you. And what that does is, maybe your neighbor's willing to do it for $20, but you have to call a licensed plumber, and he's going to charge you $150. What that does is that makes things very expensive. And if you follow the money in those types of systems, the big plumbing companies, which are, you know, there are big plumbing companies. A lot of people, they own their little truck and they have their own business. They're usually franchised under a name, and there's usually some sort of central system that has, you know, they put lots of money into advertising. And because they're advertising, they get the phone call and they say, okay, this house, let me call up one of the plumbers who's a part of this franchise, and they'll send, it's this whole thing. It's kind of like an Uber almost, except everybody's branded and sometimes they have the uniforms and the trucks and everything else. And these companies can go to Congress and say, look, there are these people out here who are fixing their neighbor's plumbing for really low prices, and we can't compete with that because we're putting all our money into advertising. We need to make that money back, which means we need to charge really high prices. And we can't charge really high prices if everybody's fixing their neighbor's plumbing for really cheap. So what do? They say, you're not allowed to do plumbing unless you have a license. And this is not capitalism. this is what a lot of people think is capitalism, but this is not capitalism. This is government. If government were not there to prohibit somebody from practicing plumbery, whatever you want to call it, if government was not there, these people would have to lower their prices. They might go out of business, right? These big companies, they might have to stop charging for all of the franchise companies, which means all the individuals who already own their own trucks. And yes, there are a lot of businesses like this. Auto repairs is one where, you know, a lot of people, even if you're working for some of the big auto repair companies or even the auto dealers, right? If you work for Hyundai or Honda or Ford, you have to buy your own tools sometimes. So if you have your own tools and you have your own knowledge, what do you need them for, right? That's kind of the question. That's just some capitalist scheme that they have. No, there's with plumbing, it's you can't go out on your own because you need the license. You need to pay for it. It becomes expensive. And by making that expensive, that makes you have to join and become a franchise because that's the only way you're guaranteed bigger returns and to charge higher prices and all these other things. But you're not allowed to just fix your neighbor's plumbing anymore. So with auto mechanics, okay, so this is an interesting question that comes along with that. Okay, but licensing is good because that makes sure that all the plumbers know what they're doing. The electricians aren't going to electrocute themselves and all these other things. It's a decent argument, but the reality is you have auto mechanics who actually have their own process of certifying themselves for becoming, you know, for acknowledging their capability to work on different parts of a car. They have certification programs that are not mandated by government, right? You can't be fined and arrested unless they've changed it recently. You can't be fined and arrested for fixing your neighbor's car if you know how to do it and you don't have a license, right? So this is an important distinction. There are programs, but at the same time, if you work for a big company and you say, oh, well, we only want to make sure that we hire people who know what they're doing. Or let's say you go to your neighbor and say, well, I want you to fix my car, but does he really know what he's doing? Does he have a license? Well, it's not a license anymore. It's a certification. He went somewhere and proved to somebody who reviewed his skills and maybe tested his knowledge. And they said, yeah, well, you know how to do what you're doing. And so he's been certified now and he's able to show that certificate to you. Now, if you didn't have one, maybe you'll still trust him to change your oil or change your spark plugs or, you know, do something minor. You might not trust him to take your entire engine apart. But if you need a bigger job like that, you would ask him, well, do you have a certificate? And maybe he can show it to you. These are all the ways that these things can work without having government mandated licensing. And the government mandated part is the government part, and that's not capitalism. And when you get that out of the equation, capitalism really, really isn't that bad. So one more thing I want to talk about is, and for anybody who's just joining, go ahead and put your comments down there and respond to what I'm saying. If you think I'm right, if you think I'm wrong, if you think I'm crazy. The UBI, the Universal Basic Income, this has become a pretty popular idea lately. And it sounds great. And I've even heard some anti-tax people say, yeah, this would be a great idea. So let's talk about this. The UBI is basically the idea that everybody would receive some sort of basic living wage. And that would be the money that they receive. Now, some of the anti-tax people say this would be a good thing because they say, okay, if somebody's on welfare and they're receiving $2,000 in benefits, now they just, but maybe it's like food stamps and they can only spend it on certain things. Maybe it's housing subsidies, which, you know, they can only spend in a certain way. That's gone. We're just going to give them $1,000 in cash. So now we're giving them less. You're still, some people say, setting the poverty line. You're still making people become dependent on government, right? And that's kind of a whole other issue of another problem, right? You're creating dependency on something, which if that system were to ever collapse, if something were to ever go wrong, like the government shuts down again and they're not mailing out checks, a lot of people are going to be in trouble, especially if this program is applied nationwide. If it's applied statewide, then you have the problem of, well, all this is a free country and you're free to go between states however you please, right? What if somebody's been living in one state for 30 years and paying their taxes into that state, and now they want to go to another state that has a UBI and they haven't been paying into, they haven't been paying their taxes into this other state. But now since they're in that state, they get to receive the UBI, right? So now it's this whole, we're creating more problems about, you know, we hear this about our border problem with Mexico, that people are going to cross this border, they're going to go to a place and receive a benefit that they haven't been paying into this whole time. We're recreating that problem. So it can't be applied at the state level, it has to be applied at the federal level. And if it goes down at the federal level, then everybody gets screwed. So there are a lot of problems just built into the system. Now, $1,000 a person is a lot of money. If we look at, you know, 320 million people in the United States, $1,000 a person is what, $320 billion per month. You look at 12 months and you're looking at $3.6 trillion, more or less. $3.6 trillion. We are right now $22 trillion in debt. And our deficit is about $1 trillion a year. Our deficit would quadruple to $4 trillion a year because we're going to be spending an extra $3 trillion. Now, the people who are promoting this, there's a presidential candidate promoting this. His idea is there are all these companies who are making billions of dollars in profit, billions with a B, not trillions. They're making all of this money in profits, and they shouldn't be that wealthy, right? Their value to these corporations that they've created is not that valuable. And these aren't the CEOs. These are the stockholders, because the stockholders are, those are the people who make the real money, right? The CEOs, even if they make millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, they might be stockholders as well, but the stockholders are the people who really make that money. There's a couple different things we can look at with this. One is, where is that money? If you look at somebody who owns, maybe somebody who has $500 billion, let's say, of Amazon stock, he's worth $500 billion. That's stock. That's not money. You can't go to his bank and say, okay, well, empty out his bank account. We're gonna hand out checks to everybody in the country. That's not how it works. If you want that money, you're going to have to take that money to the stock market. And you're going to have to sell. If you want to sell, you know, let's look at 1 month, right? If you want to fund 1 month of this UBI and you need $320 billion, you're going to have to take $320 billion worth of stock to the market and sell it. And what happens when you sell that much stock? I mean, think about it. That's a lot of stock. That's what, a third of what Apple's entire value is. Apple's the biggest the biggest market cap company, which basically means that if you add up the value of all their shares, it's worth, I think it's $1 trillion. Maybe that was a while ago, maybe it's whatever. A third of all of Apple's stock for 1 month of UBI, you'd have to sell all of that stock. Imagine what would happen. That's going to tank the market. Somebody's got to buy that stock, right? And if you can't sell the stock at full price, what happens? If you're going to sell $320 billion, you're not going to sell it to one person, right? You're going to sell it in small chunks. This is how the market works. When you put $320 billion worth of stock on the market, people start buying it. And everyone says, oh, well, okay, yeah, that's just the rate. I'll buy some of it. But then that's it. If everybody who's willing to pay that price has bought it, okay, there are always shares for sale. But how does the market work? Well, we got to sell more. Let's lower the price. So you lower the price and you lower the price and you lower the price until you can sell $320 billion. And once you start doing that, you crash the market. When you sell a third of an entire company as big as Apple's stock, you're going to crash the market. And this is the only way to extract this wealth from people, because it's not sitting in a bank. Banks don't hold hundreds of billions of dollars in their vault. You can't just walk in and say, I'd like to withdraw $320 billion. They don't even have it in their bank accounts, in their checking accounts. So they can't even write you a check. That's not how this whole system works. So to think that you could just go to these people and get this money is in and of itself insane. That cannot happen. Physically cannot happen. You can't send the army in to get that money from them because it doesn't exist. You can take their assets, but you've got to exchange those assets for cash so that you can give the cash to these people. And what happens when you're done destroying one company and you move on to the next and the next? And every month you're going to have to go and destroy another company to take all this money. That's an insane amount of money. It's a lot. Now, here's the other interesting thing about this. This guy who's really promoting this plan, he uses the argument that, you know, 10, 20, 50 years from now, what's going to happen is a lot of these jobs are going to be replaced by automation, right? So let's say you have a car factory, automation everywhere, right? Everything's automated. No employees. So now, because there are no employees, there's no expense, the company is going to be making now so many more billions and billions and trillions of dollars, right? Because their expense has gone down. And so now their profit's going to go way up. There's a flaw in that thinking, right? Because what happens? What happens if you're manufacturing a million cars per, let's say a million cars per month, and everybody loses their job? Who's got money to buy a car? Are all of these people who just lost their jobs going to go out and say, oh, well, I'm going to go buy a car because I don't have a job now. What else is there for me to do except buy a car? They're not going to do that. So when you start losing jobs because they've been replaced by automation, one of two things is going to happen. One, people are going to stop buying cars. Or two, they're going to find other jobs that maybe they pay less. And when they have other jobs that pay less, and the companies are now manufacturing all these cars, they're going to say, well, shit, if we're going to sell these cars, we got to lower the price. And guess what? They can afford to lower the price because they don't have any employees to pay to make them, right? So it's really interesting that everything, if you don't force it, everything kind of dynamically just figures out a way for itself to fit back together. Now, I know there's a lot of pain and suffering in the world, right? And it's easy to just blame capitalism. It's easy to just say, that guy's rich and I'm not, so he must have cheated to get ahead. I used to think the same way, but that's really not the case. And I've described some scenarios where some people do cheat to get ahead, and it's true. And if you want to prosecute these people for any crimes that they've committed, then absolutely do that. But we also have to realize that what the government does when the government tampers with capitalism and tries to manipulate the rules, or when one company comes in and says, I'm going to somehow work with Congress to come up with some new rules so that I can make things in my favor. I can make sure that nobody can sell anything even close to my product because there's a law. I have no competition, so I can raise my prices. That's all criminal. That's absolutely criminal. They're taking away your freedom of choice. They're threatening with force people who from participating in a free market. And they're jacking prices up, which is hurting everybody. This is criminal, but this is only done with the power of government. If government were not there, it could not be done, except for maybe the mafia. But of course, the mafia, even if you look at the mafia, what were they doing, right? You look at alcohol during Prohibition. You look at gangs today selling drugs during Prohibition. These people mostly make their money off of doing things where there's no competition, right? Because it's a black market. Nobody's allowed to, you know, in the 20s, nobody could sell their alcohol because the mob wanted to sell theirs. Today, nobody can sell their cannabis or their other drugs. Why? Because the big gangs want to sell theirs. The cartels will have territory fights. And why? Because it's illegal. And they love that. They love that it's illegal because as soon as it becomes legal, prices go down, cartels go out of business. We've seen this. Like there used to be so much cannabis, marijuana imported from Mexico into the U.S. And as soon as it became legal in the U.S. and all these states started allowing it to be grown and sold, not only did we see a higher quality in the product, not only can you get all these different types now, edibles and everything else that you know what's in it, they're safer now because you know what's in it. And yeah, okay, people are probably going to go get the, you know, the biggest dosing they can just because they want, but you don't have to worry that it's got formaldehyde in it, or that you're going to be, you know, smoking something that's laced with other drugs that might kill you. You don't have to worry about those problems anymore. And the only reason the prices are as high as they are, as they were, is because of the taxes put on them. But the cartels are pissed off about this because they're not able to sell their money. The criminal organizations are no longer profiting from this. Why? Because government got out of it for the most part. Of course, there's still government there, still restricting it in so many different ways. But we see this. We know this happens all the time. So, you know, this, it's not just in things that we consider illegal, things that most people consider immoral or unethical, right? A lot of people think drugs are immoral or unethical, and that's why they're illegal. And that creates a black market. And that creates, you know, that creates, in a black market, monopolies, right? There are also monopolies created without black markets, things that we do consider ethical, like plumbing services, right? We don't consider our plumbers to be unethical, but we allow them to create monopolies through laws and licensing requirements. Even taxis do this. Down here in Cancun, they're starting to create, you know, a lot of people are doing the Airbnb, right? And Cancun is known for all these hotels. They have all these hotels along the beach. They're beautiful, you know, beautiful, clean sand, blue water, everything else. It's so nice. And the hotels spent a lot of money building these hotels. All like, it's like a couple miles of just hotels all along the beach. Like, it's not like hotels going back from the coast. They're just all right along the coast. Beautiful real estate. And they put all of their money into that, thinking we're going to make this all back. We're all going to make a lot of profit. And I'm sure a lot of them have already made all their money back. But as they continue to operate as a business, they want more money. And so now they're starting to create laws to regulate other businesses doing Airbnb around Cancun. And it's not in the U.S. Sometimes we have some cities that'll start making rules because of that. And they'll say it's because of noise and you know, complaints, parties. And yeah, maybe those things happen. But here we have an instance where they're trying to create legislation to ban competition with the hotels, because they don't want people going to, they don't want people going all the way down to Cancun and paying lower prices to stay in anywhere else. They only want to charge their high prices for their really nice hotels. It's a monopoly. And this is only possible with government. If government were not there, who's going to ban Airbnb or any of these, like, you know, vacation rental places? Nobody. Government is the only one who can threaten to go into your bank account, take your money away, take your assets away, seize your house, arrest you. Government is the only one. They're the only ones who can do this. And that is not capitalism. That is government. So we need to really draw that line and see where that is. So I'm sure I've talked more than enough about this subject. Hopefully you guys all learned something. And, you know, if you do have any questions or comments, if you have any rebuttals to anything I've said, you can always message me on this Berman 2020 site. That's facebook.com/Berman2020. And I'm also on Instagram, Dan Berman. And you can go to youtube.com/taxationistheft. I've got a channel there with lots of interviews from the podcast that I run and lots of informational videos about taxes. And until the next time I see you, taxation is theft.